Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
And we're whispering here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. And I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with co-host Jake Towns. Gene DiNardo coming along in a few minutes, too. And the big news today coming out of the Eurozone. This particular article I'm reading from comes from Anthony Karasava, writing for the Los Angeles Times, reporting from Athens. Greece's parliament on Thursday passed crucial legislation implementing very unpopular austerity measures demanded by international creditors to unbolt rescue funds and ease fears of Europe's first sovereign default. And the legislation enabling swift implementation of $40 billion in budget cuts plus a $72 billion sell-off of state assets was backed by 155 lawmakers of the country's 300-member parliament. 5 abstained, 4 were absent, and 136 lawmakers, mainly opposition conservatives, interestingly enough, voted against the bill. And simultaneously, another piece of news is coming from Reuters. One of the people who voted against it was a member of the ruling majority party, the socialists. Rebel socialist lawmaker, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, Panagiotis Karoubalis, was expelled from his party on Wednesday for voting against the 5-year austerity plan. So, Jake, all kinds of heck breaking loose over in Greece.
Oh, yeah, and you have to keep things in mind, too. Like, the Greeks, there's massive riots in the street every day. The police are shooting tear gas at protesters. Protesters are throwing rocks back. They're wrecking shops all over Athens and elsewhere in the country. And you have to remember that what they're really protesting is the government taking away their free money. And as Margaret Thatcher back in the 80s used to say, the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money. And just for some examples, like in an article out of the Daily Mail, it goes into some of the brief facts about Greece that a lot of people aren't aware of. Like anyone that goes to Athens will see they have a brand new air-conditioned subway with plasma monitors, and you know, to get away from the hot Greek sun. It's quite a luxurious subway. And every citizen of Athens is entitled to use it for free, or they're supposed to, on an honor system, check in as they board a train, but they never, ever do it. And what it's led to is that the annual income from the Athens subway is only about 90 million euros, but the wage bill, just to pay the workers... Just to pay the workers on the subway alone is 550 million euros. So it's no surprise that really is running at cost. And you know, when you take a look at how that subway system came into play, it was the Athens Olympics. Brussels literally gave Greece some money so that they would have a modern subway to avoid, like, the traffic jams and everything. But everything that you go into in every realm of Greek life is just kind of rife with this type of either, call what you will, corruption or gravy train. Citizens there, there's no really particular IRS, but a lot of the Greek, if you look at the Greek statistics, everybody in Greece is really, really poor. But the fact of the matter is, everybody, it's a fact of the matter, you lie about your taxes, and then you give bribes to the tax officials so that they don't come after you, and that's how the tax officials make their living. It's like a fact of life. So it's interesting to kind of see this all play out. Of course, what's something that won't be reported on too much in the news is that the Federal Reserve, along with all the other central banks, decided to extend its unlimited swap lines to the European banking system. And what that literally means is the European central banks can lend to its commercial banks whatever dollars that they need, which, you know, are coming from somewhere, the American taxpayer. And technically, they're repo transactions, which means that they should be paid back. But the fact of the matter is, we are, in effect, granting bailout after bailout after bailout.
Will we be allowed to use their subway for free?
Just have to get there, yeah.
You know, I don't quite get the political spectrum. It said every conservative voted against it.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
And they would be doing cartwheels here for it, and then all the socialists voted for it except the one, and they kicked him out of his party. It seems like...
Well, that's the thing. In Greece, it's both parties are socialists. There's just one party that calls itself a different name. That's kind of all it really comes down to. Because if there was any type of, if there was, like, say, a party that came out and said, "Oh, we need to stop all this spending. We need to cut government spending. We need to get our debt under control," there's no possible way that they would be elected. As a matter of fact, the only reason, now they did split down, roughly down party lines, but the only reason that vote passed is because Greece can't get its bailout unless they pass it. And, it's something that, for sure the Greek officials are thinking to themselves, the entire political class is, okay, you know, we're forced into doing this vote, let's just do it, and, but, at the end of the day, who knows what they're actually going to follow? They just want the money. And
There was talk. There was quite a opposition to it, and they wanted to just forget about the whole euro thing and do their own thing. But the problem I think they'd run against is just they just don't have much production. You know, whether they'd be able to provide for themselves is a good question.
And of course, it's not enough by itself to have this austerity budget. In fact, Gene, I know you have some details about how the rest of the eurozone is trying to chip in to fill this gaping hole of red ink that Greece is currently swimming in.
Yeah, it was a big part of the vote, probably. The European Union said it would help Greece access billions of euros in what's called EU development funds. In an attempt to boost the nation's struggling economy and sweeten unpopular austerity measures, which, as you said, they just passed. The European Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, said Thursday that the EU is prepared to reduce the amount of money Greece has to come up with to co-fund these projects. These are basically work projects and subsidies, and normally the countries have to come up with 50%, but they reduced that to 15%. The Commission, which manages the funds, and other EU member states also will set up a program of technical assistance to ensure debt-laden Greece uses the money to stimulate economic growth and create new jobs. The funds are designed to help underdeveloped regions catch up with richer parts of the 27-nation bloc. About 15 billion euros, which is 22 American, is still available for Greece until 2013, but... You know, and to this point, they've really shown that they can. They don't even know if they can come up with the 15%, actually. So
so basically, they're throwing more money right down the hole.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what it amounts to.
Printing it before they throw it.
Yeah, well, you know, you have to take step one before you can take step two, but nevertheless.
That was a big part of the vote, I'm sure.
Going back to that Los Angeles Times article, there's an interesting paragraph that's kind of a follow-up to what we've been talking about here, as well as to what was in that article. The quote from Yanis, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, I'm sure, Varoufakis, who is a professor of economics at Athens University, and his reaction to the vote and to the aid package is that, quote, "None of this is practically feasible. Privatizations at a quick-fire pace will not yield the targeted revenues. It'll be a waste of assets." That's really interesting. I mean, an economist basically coming out and saying that all this austerity is not going to accomplish anything. It's almost like it's a breath of fresh air. It makes you wonder, which side is he actually coming from? Is he coming from the point of view that all of the monetization and so forth is destroying Greece and that has to be stopped? Or is he coming from the point of view that we don't have enough gravy running, so we have to turn the whole ladle over?
Yeah, or is he just looking at it practically, you know?
It's hard to tell. I mean, the one thing we do know about Greece is that, as Jake was saying earlier, basically money flows in the streets. I don't know of a better way to put it. I mean, Jake, you know a better way to put it than that?
No.
That pretty much describes it. Meanwhile, of course, we're experiencing our own fun with debt deadlines and debt ceilings. And, Jake, what are the latest details on what's going on with Washington trying to come to grips with its own debt mire?
Right. Well, President Barack Obama came under fire in his third press conference of the year yesterday. And what he came under fire for was the whole debt talks and talks about trying to continue to raise the debt ceiling. President Obama is, of course, for raising the debt ceiling. But what was interesting was the things that he says that we need to do along the way. And he's very much a proponent of, he came out and said that we need to continue stimulus efforts in order to goose the American economy. And that's interesting, of course, because the famous 2009 stimulus plan, which took place immediately after he was elected, and Americans sometimes have not so good memories, failed to create a single job, and was a large failure. The unemployment rate obviously is still quite high. The jobless reports just came out with another 400,000 claims report today. So what it comes down to is that the Secretary of the Treasury, Tim Geithner, is stating that August 2nd is the day to end all days. Like, that's the day that will technically be in default, and they'll have to. Well, of course, the government's not really going to stop paying itself first. It's going to stop paying retirees.
Yeah.
So I'm sure that the uproar from the retirees should be large enough to get anything passed. But the whole thing is that this isn't the right way to run a country, and they're just trying to more or less strong-arm the bill through. And meanwhile, what the president is saying has some truth to it. Like, the Republicans are saying that they won't approve it, and all that the president's pointing out, and the Democrats, really, the Democrats in the presidency is the same thing, is that we already approved all this spending. You already approved all this spending. We need to continue it now. And it's kind of bringing out the true colors, I guess, of both parties, because, when the Democrats come out and say, let's cut $10 billion, all that John Boehner and the Republicans need to come out with is say, okay, let's cut $30 billion, and it doesn't do anything in the great scheme of things. But all the Republicans need to do is to look slightly better than the Democrats. And the thing is, if they do that, there's no other competition to the Republican Party. So guess what? They're going to do well in the next election. They just need to stay, a little bit away from the Democrats. And what's the shame about all this is that it's just the politicians trying to stay in office. Meanwhile, the people that are going to be paying the cost of it is certainly not going to be your government bureaucrat. It's going to be the citizens of the country, the people that they claim to serve. It's vice versa.
That's a great point. I think a thing that really emphasizes that is the Republicans who say they're against tax increases, and the Democrats, especially Obama, who is pushing to close the tax loopholes. And the Republicans come back with that and say, well, that's a tax increase. Well, a loophole is, in reality, it is a tax increase for someone. But I think if you're going to have taxes, they should be try to be fair with them. I mean, most libertarians aren't for taxes, and I'm not especially. But, calling a loophole a tax increase for everyone is just part of what you've been talking about. It's just political nonsense.
Unfortunately, there's no such thing as a fair tax.
That's right.
If there ever was a fair tax, then it might be a different situation, but no one's ever come up with a fair tax.
That's true.
Meanwhile, more stuff going on. This is the end of QE2. Well, not really, but officially QE2, the quantitative easing program of the Federal Reserve, ends today. So where are the celebrations? Oh, well, I guess there's no celebrations because there's really not an end to it. It's actually QE endless. But, Jake, what do you have about the end of QE2?
Yeah, well, probably the most interesting thing is that this morning when QE2 officially ended, the interest rates on the Treasury bills skyrocketed really about 20 or 30 basis points. They ended up only up on the day about 5, but you had a very large increase from roughly on the 10-year bill from 3.1% to 0.22% over a course of about a half an hour. And something happened along the way to kind of cool that down. It was probably the Fed continuing to buy it. The Fed purchased, the last reported purchase was $5 billion in treasuries on June 29th, yesterday. And what a lot of people don't quite realize is that if you go through the FOMC meeting, and we might have not highlighted this quite as much, but what the FOMC meeting state from the Federal Reserve is that not only are they keeping the interest rates at near zero, but that the quote to the committee will complete its purchases of $600 billion of longer-term Treasury securities by the end of this month and will maintain its existing policy of reinvesting principal payments from security holdings, unquote.
Hence the QE, it's endless.
Right, right, and that's projected to be about $300 billion a year, roughly, and that's just a rough estimate, but everything, and that's all the treasuries that the Fed has kind of ever owned, is going to be just flowing back into this program, and that's kind of like not trumpeted as much, because what the Fed was trying to avoid was trying to avoid the title of quantitative easing. But when you take a look at a lot of the monetary indicators, on the Fed balance sheet, the U.S. Treasuries is now $1.6 trillion, so they'll be holding those for quite some time. And the monetary indicators of M1 and M2 just hit all-time highs. The M1, which is the rough amount of currency in circulation outside of banks demand deposits, that was very close. It was about $1.9 trillion. And for the first time ever, M2, which includes saving deposits primarily and money market funds, for the first time ever, that hit $9 trillion. The rate of increases, the annual rate of increase, is about 13% for the currency in circulation and 5% when you add the currency in circulation plus the savings amounts and money market funds. So the money, there's a lot more money.
Money's there.
A lot more dollars. And we'll see how things go. Gold is down today just a tad, about $1,500 a troy ounce, which is about $50 to $70 away from its all-time high. So they're obviously trying to keep gold and silver subdued while this is going on.
Jake, you mentioned one figure that kind of caught my attention, the monetary base at $1.9 trillion. Last I checked, it was about $2.5 trillion. I wonder if that number should have been $2.9 trillion. Do you know?
This is the M1. Oh, sorry. If I said monetary base, I probably misstated. It's the M1 statistic.
Oh, okay, M1, yeah, which is not the same thing as the monetary base. I'm
sure. I apologize if I said
okay, yeah. All the M's are hard to keep track of.
There's a lot of them out there.
No doubt about it. And the thing that just really strikes my attention is the fact that despite the fact that all this money is being created, and despite the fact that there's some actually pretty smart people who invest in Wall Street and even invest from home and so on and so forth, there doesn't seem to be yet a whole lot of recognition of just what the impact of all this monetary quantitative easing is going to do. And the Fed, like you've been talking about, Jake, there, they just continue to get away with creating more and more and more of it. At some point, they're going to, the vast financial community is going to sit up and take notes and say, hey, wait a minute, there's a whole bunch of money out there, and that's bad.
Yeah, well, the tactics are becoming more and more draconian because we talked about in March, there was the announcement from Walmart that they expect inflation to hit that company very hard. The latest company to talk about inflation was the largest bottler in the country, Coca-Cola, saying that its prices will rise 3 to 5% beginning after July 31st. So if you want to buy soda, buy it before July 31st.
Soda now.
Yeah, sugar or water must be going up because there's nothing else in it.
And that'll be about an increase of 5 to 6% this year just for Coca-Cola. And obviously they're feeling a bit squeezed themselves. So you kind of have that going on, but at the same time, it's hard to say, you know, what the outcome of all this is going to be, but it's probably going to be rising prices for the average man, the average family. They're going to be seeing the cost increases. Same time, they're going to be out of work. And everything that you see the president doing is being done really to maintain those ever-important approval ratings, which I believe he's doing not a bad job at.
I think mentioning that they're going to be out of work is probably why the prices haven't increased as much right now. It's just that I think the demand is down. You know, people just aren't buying as much.
Well, but you also have a lot of times the government kind of goosing things. And when I say that things are getting more and more draconian, I don't think you really need to look too far. I mean, oil topped out about $115 a barrel and was falling. It was at $95 and change a barrel when the federal government decided to release 30 million barrels of crude onto the marketplace.
That was very interesting, right?
Yeah, and with that, what it did was it drove down. What's very interesting is that it drove down momentarily the price of oil. Maybe call it $4 a barrel is down to about $90 a barrel and change. And today, the last time I checked, it was back up to 95. And what a lot of folks don't realize, and the release came from the United States Strategic Reserve, which is only supposed to be tapped in the event of a dire emergency. And, you know, to give people the example of the last two times that it was tapped was for the first Gulf War, which really didn't end in Iraq, in 1991. And then also Hurricane Katrina, when all the refineries were impacted by that event. So those you could definitely say, well, you know, you can have a debate about whether they should be holding this much oil, but it is kind of those were emergencies. And here, you know, the cost for oil was dropping, and all the government stated was, oh, it was done because of the Arab Spring and the war in Libya.
That's really bad timing in another respect, because if it would have been implemented just before the price dropped, they could have claimed that they caused the drop. Would have been a political victory, you know.
True. But I think that what's more on the minds of President Obama and the federal government is really we should try to keep the consumers somewhat satiated during the summer, because it is vacation time. And the last thing that any American wants to be thinking about is what the government's doing with its own money. And, you know, like I just mentioned, the Federal Reserve re-extended its swap agreements to bail out the European Union. The IMF has a new head and she is obviously a French person, stated obviously that they're going to help bail out Greece as well. So that's the whole story and the whole the whole 10 yards, I guess, so to speak.
It's an inflation of yardage.
But what is happening, and I just want to highlight, is that you have the President of the United States taking place in manipulating prices.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's, you know, in the grand scheme of things, 30 million barrels of oil sounds like a lot. It's the world, it could run the world on oil for about 8 hours, so about a third of the day. So that's really all that they, kind of the time that they bought from that. And it's inconsequential in the larger scheme of things. And like I said, you know, the price just popped right back up to it. So they had, you know, a beneficial effect for about a week or so. But eventually, you know, these types of things just don't work. And, well, I shouldn't say that. They work for their – it did drop the price of oil, because people on the futures markets were like, well, you know, are they going to dump more, or, you know, this is a sign that, you know, the price needs to go down. And at the same time, you know, I can't help but think that approval numbers is the main reason that this is being done.
Political move, right?
Absolutely true, I'm sure. And Gene, you also mentioned the idea that when you have the unemployment, it's also going to affect demand. But there is one area of demand that's going to remain unaffected. In fact, actually, you could say the reverse. The demand, in one sense, increases because the urgency becomes so bad. And that's for the basics, the food, the clothing, the shelter. Even when you're unemployed, you still have to pay for those things one way or another. And you do end up doing that, whether it's through a government benefit or whatever. But bottom line is the demand for those things never goes away, and the intensity starts to build so that people end up being willing to pay a higher price. They don't like it, but they're willing to pay a higher price because they figure they've got to keep body and soul together.
Yeah,
so,
right. They don't have a choice, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's one reason why we do tend to see food prices, for instance, have been increasing over the last year. We're going to start seeing it with clothing. We have seen it over the last 10 years with real estate prices, actually 10 to 15 years. There was a drop-off, obviously, with the financial crisis in 2008, and real estate prices have fallen considerably. But even so, the levels that they're at right now are well above where they were at the end of the 20th century. And that's, of course, just, 11 years ago. So.
Oh yeah, they are, and they're above what. I think they're still high. I mean, for functioning, you know, what people earn as opposed to what they can afford to pay for a mortgage, they're still high.
Yeah, and the ironic part is that this is actually the target of all this monetary creation, the Fed, the European zone, everybody trying to thrust all this money in order to get Americans to borrow more money again to buy houses at inflated prices, and thereby drive the real estate market back up. That's what the aim of all this insanity is.
Exactly, because the banks own all the real estate securities, the banks and the central banks and all the financial institutions, and we wouldn't want to have them hurting.
Absolutely not.
No.
And by the way, there's a new video on the homepage of our website at www.freedomnewshour.com. It's one I created in response to the Robert Reich video, which we discussed last week on the show, and I went into a little bit more detail about what's particularly wrong with that video, but with the Reich video, you might want to watch it. It's only about 10 minutes long, and one of the points that I made in there is in that video is just what we're talking about here, that this whole thing is a debt-based monetary system-driven mechanism designed to reinflate the economy and make things look like everything's good again. One of the things that really caught my attention in that Reich video is a comment that Reich made, and we touched on this last week, but I want to touch on it once more, and that is the solution in his view is that we must enable the middle class to borrow more money. That is what his idea of a strong middle class is. And I think it's fair to say it's probably true of a lot of the Democratic leadership, even some of the Republican leadership. In fact, I would say the vast majority of all the moderates in both parties, they tend to agree with this viewpoint that the whole solution to the entire economic situation is to have the American middle class go deeper and deeper debt in order to buy inflated real estate. I mean, it's a crazy notion, but that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and it really goes against the strongest, you know, if you consider the 50s and 60s, which was probably the strongest era for the middle class anywhere, you know, at any time in the world, and there was very low debt ratios, especially compared to modern times at that time. I mean, people had small debt and mortgages, but the comparison to now, you can't even compare it.
Absolutely true. Well, we're going to take a break in a moment here, and after the break, we've still got quite a bit to cover, including news from Afghanistan and Libya, where, of course, we're spending lots more money that we don't have and can't afford to spend, but nevertheless, we're spending it anyway, and we're doing it at the cost of human life. Plus, we're also going to be touching on what's going on with our favorite congressman, Ron Paul of Texas. Interesting things going on there, particularly with his attempts to take a look at just how much gold there actually is in Fort Knox and all the resistance he's getting about it, both from the government auditors and the private auditors and everybody else saying, oh, no, no problem, no problem, no problem. And meanwhile, Congressman Paul just keeps right on going. So we'll touch on all that and more after the break. This is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back.
While they're standing in the world, they're lying. Crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Dr. Vicki, I'm so excited to be on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. I'll be able to talk to you live, answer your questions, and work with you for your own patient rights. Tune in every Sunday at 5 p.m. ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. See you on Sunday, 5 p.m.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
I I'm Elaine Schnupfer, host producer of Evolving Ideas. Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, and global on the Internet. Join me each week on the Progressive Radio Network to explore the universe and our relationship to it.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your Life, Your Relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
People of all kinds are going to be taken with bears, and that's going to be where things get really bad in this country. But this is the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Welcome back. And before we go any further, I do want to let you know about an upcoming show. Next week we have a guest. His name is Mark Depp. He's from Legal Forensic Auditors, and they're actually based here in my hometown, Warrenton, Virginia. Mark's organization helps foreclosure victims fight the banks by digging into the paper trail to find glitches and screw-ups that can be used in court to get foreclosure set aside. Banks routinely do things with title trustee changes that undermine their ability to maintain control over mortgage notes if the homeowner challenges the bank in court. And this also ties into the whole MERS mess, which we've been talking about here in past episodes here on the Freedom News Hour. So it should be a very interesting and entertaining program that you won't want to miss. It's Mark Depp from Legal Forensic Auditors. He's our guest next week here on the Freedom News Hour. And, Gene, before we went to the break, I was mentioning how the U.S. continues to spend large amounts of money overseas, including in Afghanistan, where we're spending money by the billions. And I know you have some details about that. What do you have for us?
Yeah, this was the change of administration. The new administration, they promised to get it together in Afghanistan, and apparently this isn't the case. Reviewing the multi-billion-dollar U.S. aid program in Afghanistan 2 years ago, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton pronounced it as heartbreaking failure and promised to make a successful aid program that the centerpiece of a revamped strategy to defeat the Taliban. Recent U.S. government reports suggest that the Obama administration instead doubled down on a flawed strategy, pouring large sums into projects that have fueled corruption, distorted local economies, and left Afghanistan with technology it won't be able to maintain after the NATO forces leave. The bipartisan Congressional Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan said in a report this month that overly ambitious proposals, incomplete analysis, poor planning, weak coordination, and inadequate follow-through by federal officials risk wasting billions more. And it also said the Afghan economy is so dependent on military spending and international aid that it could plunge into depression in 2014 when U.S. forces are scheduled to depart. That was concluded a two-year study released last week by the Democratic majority of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The committee chairman, John Kerry, of course, he's a close ally of the president, so it was fairly unbiased, I guess. And the department and White House officials disputed that civilian aid to Afghanistan on their watch had been a failure, of course. Then it goes into what was actually spent. Starting in 2002, the George W. Bush administration spent about $10.7 billion on civilian aid in Afghanistan. The Obama administration has spent $7 billion more in 2009 and 2010 and is slated to spend an additional $3.2 billion this year. But government studies indicate that the fundamental structure of the aid programs have not changed. So they said they would reform it, and obviously they haven't. The World Bank estimates that 97% of Afghanistan's economic output is from spending related to international military and civilian presence. That's 97%, but they probably weren't counting the opium and hashish production. Anyway, they came into office, you know, claiming that they were going to clean up their act, and apparently they haven't. It may be impossible to do. I mean, it's just maybe the nature of the beast. And
That's certainly true. And, of course, with the U.S. facing a $1.5 trillion deficit, the question becomes not just with Afghanistan but with a wide range, you know, where does all the insanity end? I mean, Jake, I know you have strong opinions about that.
It's going to end with higher prices. The Wall Street Journal just came out. What's one of the funny stories, I guess, that people in the United States need to pay more and more attention to is really kind of like the dangers with the country of China and its economy, which is heavily based on ours. And you had Premier Wen Jiabao going over to Europe and, you know, pledging to support a stabler euro, pledging to buy an undisclosed amount of Greek debt. He was pledging to double trade with Greece. He was pledging to not reduce the amount of European government debt in their sovereign wealth fund, which is quite important. And yet you have to take a look at what's happening in his own country. His own country, the government's figures of inflation in China is 5.5%, which to anyone who has visited there and knows people that work there is probably about 2 to 3 times too low. So the true inflation rate is probably somewhere between 10 to 15%. And pork prices themselves have risen over 60% over the past year and are up 5% from last week. So seeing rapid price increases in that country. And it'll just be, and of course, Chinese do love to eat pork. Is that their favorite meat? That's one of the things is that, or that we need to pay attention to into the future. Really, is the discontent in China could also lead to a change in stances that China shows globally. But I don't doubt that they want a stable euro. I don't doubt that they want a stable dollar because everything's all tied together. But the fact of the matter is, while they have their currency pegged to dollars, and the money printing presses of the EU and the United States keep running, you know, they are going to be paying the price for it.
Exactly. Did you notice while living there the inflation, greater inflation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was there for 4 years, from 2005 to 2009, and it was, you know, pretty prevalent. I mean, I would say it was probably in some areas, it depends what you tried to buy. If you tried to buy foreign-made goods, you obviously saw it. If you tried to buy some goods, you would see it. In some places, you could go to, like, a neighborhood vegetable stall or whatever, and you wouldn't see any inflation rate increase, probably because they aren't aware of it. Because it is, that's the whole thing that we talked about in past weeks, is that even if inflation, like, you know, people talk about the Fed targets and, you know, the double mandate of the Federal Reserve that they claim to week after week, week in and week out, is stable prices and full employment. And full employment is obviously a big fat lie. They haven't been able to do really anything since 2007, 2008. Inflation is still persisting very close to 10%. And number two on stable prices, that's a real joke. I mean, since the Federal Reserve was founded, the dollar has lost probably about 99% of its value, especially pegged alongside gold, which it used to be pegged to. The thing is, like, even when you target 2%, 3% inflation, and I don't believe for a second that it's that low. But even if you did target that, after 10 years, you'd get rid of 50% of your debt. And that's the whole name of the game, is to make things easier on the U.S. government and the politicians.
Yeah, not easier on the rest of the population, which suffers the loss, although they don't realize it until much later. And of course, that's why what we really need is a level stable monetary system, because we don't have anything close to it right now. The fact that the monetary system continues to increase in size is what's driving all this insanity that we've been talking about, not just in this program, but in past episodes of the program.
Yeah, and that's 40% of our economy right now is the financial sector, if you can believe that. I mean, like, we need probably 4%, maybe.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's a huge industry.
Yeah.
And of course, the solution to all this is, like I said, a level stable money supply, and that's why we talk about gold and silver and hard currency here on this program, and other people talk about it as well, because that's how you ultimately take the power of the printing press where the money supply is concerned, away from the government and away from the bankers, and basically end the insanity. In fact, I think we noted, Jake, you'll have to remind me on this, I thought we did touch on it about 1 or 2 weeks ago, the person who is the creator of the euro, the father of the euro, Professor Robert Mundell, came out a couple weeks back about the idea of gold convertibility for the euro and similar suggestions where the dollar is concerned, especially in light of what you just mentioned, Jake, where the Fed just continues to put the pedal to the metal and completely fails to deal with any of their statutory mandates. The unemployment is out of control. The inflation rate is much higher than what's actually being reported. In light of all that, it's not only interesting that Professor Mundell came out in favor of that a couple weeks ago, but I think we're probably going to start seeing more of that over the next couple weeks, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, you're going to see a lot of these mainline economists kind of hedge their bets, too. I mean, Barry Eichengreen, who I saw give a talk, I guess it was last year at some point, when he's a very well-known Keynesian economist, he just came out with a book called Exorbitant Privilege, which is all about the fact that the United States has the world's reserve currency and that we can print money and because other people use it for trade. And I don't have the details in front of me, but there was just a, I think UBS did a survey of central bankers and very large sovereign wealth fund managers and asked them, you know, do you see over the next 25 years the U.S. dollar continuing as a reserve currency? And the results of the survey was emphatically no. And we're going to be seeing the U.S. dollar move away from that. And unfortunately, it's probably, and here's where I'm just conjecturing, but it's probably going to end up coming down to a crisis, hopefully not as bad as all the riots going on in Greece, of course, but you just have to wonder where this ship is going.
And, well, it's certainly not looking like it's heading in the right direction.
No.
I think it's one reason why we often point to Congressman Ron Paul, because he's one of the very, very few in Congress here in the United States who has consistently spoken out against this kind of thing, usually to deaf ears. But lately he's been getting more and more attention because people are beginning to recognize, hey, that crazy guy actually gets it right.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. He's also a chairman of a subcommittee for the House, I think, Financial Services, and the subcommittee is on monetary policy. So he just held a, I think it was like after our show last week, he held a hearing where he brought in the auditors from the Treasury and the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, and the auditors, and kind of queried them on the gold that was there. And they were discussing on the details of how to carry out a audit of the U.S. Gold reserves. And what was really funny was the auditors spend the entire time wherever they had a chance saying, it's all there, we have it. We test all these bars, we drill into these bars, we have these results, which weren't shared with the public. They
of
did
course.
Say that they gave some stuff to Congressman Paul. But what was there was a few things that were extremely fishy from the whole testimony. One is that they claim that just if a vault has a seal over it, that they don't need to go in and re-audit the whatever gold is there. So literally they're saying, yeah, we don't need to go and take a look at it as long as you have the seal over a door, which I found to be quite odd. And then number two, the Treasury auditor was just caught completely flat-footed when he was asked about the gold that the United States has given to the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. And I was trying to figure out exactly how much we've given to the IMF. It's on the order of hundreds of metric tons for sure. That and the thing is, when the IMF was first created, that was supposed to be kind of like pledged and promised to, so theoretically it's supposed to belong back to Washington, D.C. So one of the other congressmen there, it wasn't Congressman Paul, it was another one, asked, you know, where exactly is the IMF gold? Is it in our vaults? Is it in the IMF vault? If it's in the IMF vault, does it technically belong to us? Because the IMF has been giving away gold. They had a 400 metric ton sale that they were just, you know, giving away to supposedly countries that were poor, such as India and Bangladesh. And what it kind of came down to is that the auditor had no clue. He stated that he would get back to at some point, back to the congressman on whatever the answer is, but that should just be kind of a dead giveaway that, you know, there's something fishy going on. Like, if the auditor doesn't know where the gold is, who the heck does? And second, when he was asked, because there's other instruments, like it's also surmised, and it's probably from the Bundesbank, the German National Bank. There is a very, very large degree of probability, probably close to 100%, that the United States is involved in some amount of gold swaps. Now, there will be people that tell you it's a very large percentage of the gold reserves. There will be people that say it's smaller. We don't really know. But what the gold swap is that, say, like the German Central Bank says, okay, we are going to store our 100 tons of gold in your vault, and we're going to put out into the marketplace 100 of our tons from our vault, but we still want to own that, or we pledge to pay it back to you with gold in the future. And the thing is that when these auditors were asked, like, you know, are there any gold swaps encumbering the U.S. gold reserves, the only thing that they were able to say was that, to their knowledge, they weren't able to say emphatically that there is no encumbrances. They were just saying, you know, to our knowledge. And it's kind of funny because when you take a look at what the IMF can do, like the U.S. is the only nation that has veto power in the IMF. The Secretary of the Treasury is the one who gets the vote at the IMF. And guess who the backup for Secretary of Treasury Geithner is at the IMF with our country's votes?
That's going to be an interesting question for a number of reasons, but who is it?
It's Ben Bernanke, the chairman, the unelected federal chairman. So what's kind of funny is, you know, this whole central bank thing is kind of somewhat seamless.
Yeah, they really have it figured out.
And the reason I said that that fact about Geithner is particularly interesting is, I don't know if you guys heard, but Geithner is actually thinking about stepping down.
Yeah, I did hear that, right?
Yeah, I'm sure he's just like Hank Paulson before him, kind of counting down the days to when he can get out of that crazy world.
He probably got a job offer at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, for
well,
sure.
Well, he figures, you know, he basically helped screw the taxpayers with a TARP, and then when that was supposedly paid back, although actually it paid back with money that was created out of thin air, basically destroying the value of our dollar, he figured, well, you know, my job here is done.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the Secretary of the Treasury is a very powerful position, and it's going to be interesting to see who ends up replacing him, because, of course, Geithner came from the New York Fed. So again, things are kind of seamless. You have the one head moving to the other one. I'm sure we'll see some other Fed official or another career bureaucrat kind of step in. So
I think you're probably right, but of course
somebody from Goldman Sachs.
the getting back to Dr. Paul, the congressman from Texas, all this activity has really boosted his image to the point where his 2012 campaign, which is now underway, is getting enormous amounts of attention from the mainstream media, which, of course, 4 years ago he couldn't have bought if he had had, you know, $6 million days all in a row, because they just were not going to pay him any respect at all. But he's getting respect now. As an example, Bloomberg came out with an article just 3 days ago entitled "Ron Paul's Anti-Fed Message Drives 2012 White House Bid, Gaining Respect." And in fact, it goes through all the different details of what the major media considers to be the most important parts of the Paul campaign, particularly where the Fed is concerned. There's one little piece that I do want to bring to attention, because part of the article is about all the different ways that they try to make fun of Dr. Paul.
And one of the sources they went to make fun of Dr. Paul was Judson Phillips, the founder of Tea Party Nation. Now, Tea Party Nation has been steadfastly staying outside of the whole debate about the Fed. They have judiciously stayed outside of it. They have avoided it like the plague, and they have avoided anything having to do with Dr. Paul. Tea Party Nation is one of the largest, it may even be the largest Tea Party group in the country, quite influential within the Tea Party movement. And Phillips, in this article, was quoted as saying that he finds Dr. Paul, he agrees with Paul on some things, but on other things, such as foreign policy, he thinks that Paul's ideas are, quote, just nuts. And he goes on to say that the idea that Ron Paul started the Tea Party movement is revisionist history. That's Judson Phillips speaking. He says, people say Ron Paul's the godfather of the Tea Party. No, he isn't.
Well, I hope not.
I've got a little news for Judson Phillips. The very first Tea Party event in the modern era happened December 16th, 2007. It was a major fundraising day for Ron Paul long before Judson Phillips even came onto the political map. So, Mr. Phillips...
And they referred to it as a Tea Party at that point.
That's right.
No kidding.
Yeah, it was part of the Ron Paul Revolution was the Tea Party. It was the biggest fundraising day of the entire campaign.
Oh, what happened to it? What happened to the Tea Party? I mean.
Well, what happened afterward was that Glenn Beck came on the air, I think in April of 2009, after the election, and did his thing about a 9-12 group and so forth, and that pretty much kicked off the modern Tea Party movement. But the origins of it go back to the Ron Paul Revolution. So to hear Judson Phillips saying that Paul has no influence and has nothing to do with starting the movement basically shows that he has absolutely zero respect for Ron Paul. And I think that's a pretty good description of conservatism as a whole. Dr. Paul likes to say that he is the modern conservative, that he is the true conservative, and many of his supporters agree with him on that. But as much as I like Dr. Paul, I have to disagree with that particular designation, because I think that the Judson Phillips of the world are the true conservatives. And I say that disparagingly.
Right.
I think that the true conservatives are actually horrible for this country.
In any modern context, you're completely right.
Absolutely.
People sometimes say, "Oh, I'm a traditional conservative," but it really has no meaning anymore. You know, I think it's what you see is out there is what it is.
Yeah. The neoconservatives are actually the true conservatives these days, and Judson Phillips is very clearly a neoconservative, and in fact, his entire organization is very much of a neoconservative organization. In fact, I just wanted to throw one more piece in here. Not only are they neoconservative, but they're anti-First Amendment, believe it or not. They won't admit to that, of course, but it is true, because anyone who disagrees with them in their forums, in their site, gets banned. And I know this from experience, because that happened to me. I actually went on there to argue for Ron Paul's case, argue for the idea that we need to make the Fed the number one issue, argue for the idea that we need to look at debt-based money and make that the number one issue. And for my trouble, I was banned.
I
was banned, yeah. I'm not permitted to participate there, because anyone who speaks critically of Judson Phillips, anybody who speaks critically of what Tea Party Nation is doing and saying, hey, you guys are focusing on the wrong stuff, well, they're just not welcome.
Right. Well, neocons are basically socialists, is what they are.
Yeah, they are. They just don't want to admit it. They want to appear to be, you know, free market. They want to appear to be in favor of small government and so forth, but they're really not.
They're not, no.
So, anyway, end of that particular screed, but I wanted to kind of throw that in there, because in the context of Ron Paul gaining so much influence, I just found it really fascinating that Phillips, as the leader of one of the largest Tea Party groups in the country, feels quite comfortable in taking a swipe at him. Very interesting stuff indeed. Meanwhile, let's take one more hop across the ocean, I should say. And, Gene, you have a rather interesting report about what's been going on in Libya, which hasn't been getting a whole lot of headlines lately, but the struggle continues over there, and it's not like the bloodshed is any less real than it was 3 months ago.
Yeah, there's quite a few things. I'll kind of quickly go through the different articles, but NATO admitted to an errant missile that hit a Libyan home. They acknowledged that a missile destroyed a civilian home in the Libyan capital in the early morning. This was about a week ago, saying it may have killed civilians. It was their second admission in the three-month campaign of airstrikes against the military forces of Gaddafi. But I wanted to skip down to a neighbor's account. Let's see, the house that did get bombed had collapsed into the street, leaving a cement stairway dangling in the air from the remnant of the frame. Several carports on the block had collapsed from the blast, crushing vehicles within. A neighbor a block away invited reporters into his home to show shattered glass from windows and doors and said his wife had been taken to the hospital with wounds from the shards. So it obviously occurred. Gaddafi's been claiming, you know, different that it happens all the time, and there hasn't been any proof of it, but it does happen, and it's just bound to happen. There was a couple other things. One, the spineless Congress went back and forth on the Libyan account. By an overwhelming margin, lawmakers refused to sanction U.S. participation in a NATO campaign of airstrikes in the North African country, a vote that amounted to a rare bipartisan rebuke of a president's foreign policy during an active military conflict. And minutes later, however, a Republican-led effort to try to curb financial support for the U.S. involvement also failed. A majority of Democrats and a group of Republicans rejected the bill to cut funding for combat activities, surprising GOP leaders who tailored the bill at the last minute to suit the rank and file. So this, you know, kind of reminds me of Iraq, where you just kind of switch parties, with the Republicans pushing the Iraq war, and but, you know, the Democrats saying, well, I don't know, you know, are you telling us the truth of this? And then every time he came up a vote for funding, you know, they would pass it. So things just, the parties change, but...
Well, it sounds like it's a vote that Justin Phillips would have been very happy about, but
yeah.
yeah, it's the kind of thing that he definitely would believe in, which is kind of ironic because at some point they're going, the neoconservatives and those people who are within the Tea Party movement who are trying to support the neoconservatism, they're going to have to basically come to grips with the fact that their foreign policy just is not financially doable anymore. And until they come to grips with that, they're going to find themselves tripping over their own feet quite a bit, especially as the election proceeds. By the way, did you guys notice Jake Donovan? Maybe you noticed it. Michelle Bachmann seems to have replaced Sarah Palin in the hearts of the conservatives. I mean, latest poll that came out, Palin had fallen down well into single digits, and Michelle Bachmann had zoomed up into second place. It's almost like she got all the Palin votes.
Yeah, it's funny because Michelle Bachmann was one of those folks who ended up taking fairly early advantage of the whole Tea Party movement. And I agree with you that she certainly has. You know, at least in appearance and gender, has some relationship or some similarities to Sarah Palin. But for sure, I haven't really seen a jump in the polls, but it's been really funny because that whole Tea Party thing that she had done was really to spread out her fundraising and spread out her support name and her base over, you know, even if it's just select pools. Throughout the entire country. And it's kind of funny because, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the only thing that she's done for work outside of working as, you know, as a congresswoman has been, any guesses? She was a tax attorney for the United States government for the IRS. So she did that for 6 years, from 1988 to 1993, and she's sure. Gone on to, you know, have a political career. And she's been quite good at being a politician. And the thing is that I think that she'll be adding a different perspective to the debates than the rest of the other candidates, and I think she's really going to be trying to capitalize really on the whole Sarah Palin allure, I guess.
I think there's probably a lot of truth in that because that's pretty much what she will be doing. One question that does come to my mind, and it perhaps is just a fleeting one because it's not the kind of thing that normally happens when a president is up for re-election, but do either of you guys see any Democrats coming to the fore? And we got to be really quick here because we're running out of time. But do you see any Democrats coming up trying to challenge Obama for the nomination?
I haven't seen any. The one thing that I would add is that, like, for instance, Gary Johnson, who's in the official running for GOP but was left out of the debates and left out of pretty much everything, if you take a look at a lot of his stuff, that would be something that would probably be better off in the Democratic Party primary. Plus, with Obama not having any challengers, you know, it's something to be said. And I think I was just talking about it with someone this afternoon. When you go back and take a look at vice presidents, really Roosevelt was the last person during the middle of the Depression to keep changing vice presidents. So I'm just going to speculate here, but I think that what we might see out of the Obama campaign is nobody else against him in the Democratic primary. But maybe you'll replace Joe Biden with someone like, say, a John Kerry.
Well, unfortunately,
or,
that, but we're
like
out of
that.
Time because we've reached the top of the hour. But we'll invite you all to join us back next week here on the Freedom News Hour. And Jake and Gene, it's been a pleasure as usual.
And you too,
take
Walt.
Care, everyone.
Take
okay.
care.
Stay free.
Goodbye, everybody.